Jonathan Skinner sings of warblers, and Brenda Coltis divines ghosts in this May 8th, 2008 edition of the Rooftop Poetry Club podcast. I'm Dennis Reed. Thanks for listening.
Thanks all for coming tonight. So we're celebrating the last day of classes with a really special rooftop reading for me. Two dear friends of mine, Brenda Coltis, who's traveling here from the East Village of Manhattan, and Jonathan Skinner, who's visiting from Maine. So first we're going to start with Jonathan, and I'll give a little introduction to him. I remember the first time I heard Jonathan read from his work. He started the event with a tape recording of a mockingbird singing alongside a highway. Every time a truck would pass by, there was a moment of sacred silence before the mockingbird would start singing again, always in a distinctly new and thoughtful chant. I can't help but use this metaphor to describe Jonathan's work, as the mockingbird's repertoire contains more than 150 unique song types. I'm a librarian, so I looked all this up. Acquired through imitating the calls and songs of other birds, the vocalizations of non-avian species, and mechanical sounds, Jonathan writes using the same acute sense of observation and sensitive ear for sound. He's able to cross the boundaries between man and the environment to produce unfamiliar yet somehow familiar songs. Familiar because they often involve the surroundings in which we live, but surprisingly unfamiliar in the way they make us view our place and politics within the world. Jonathan Skinner edits the review, Ecopoetics and Field Books, teaches environmental studies at Bates College, and lives in,
Bodenham,
the tick capital of Maine. His political cactus poems are available through Palm Press. His manuscript, Wetlands, written in the Tift Farm Nature Preserve, is looking for a home. Please welcome Jonathan Skinner.
Thank you, Lisa. And let me know if the sound gets weird. Is it good sound? Can you?
It's a little high.
Lower, like that? Is that good? Okay.
Do you want me to turn it down?
Is it the volume? Does the volume need adjustment?
It's weird.
It's weird? It sounds weird. Okay, how's that? How's that?
Better.
That's better? Yeah? Okay. So yes, thank you to Lisa. Thank you to Buffalo State College, to all of you for coming out. It's great to read here. I really miss this community, so I'm grateful to be back. This is a crazy poem by Emily Dickinson I wanted to read to begin. We play at paste till qualified for pearl, then drop the paste and deem ourselves a fool. The shapes, though, were similar, and our new hands learned gem tactics, practicing sands. Okay, here's a poem I wrote with Jack Collum. Rumors of golf balls in the garden. The grasshopper leaps from a nibbled shrub, another leaps, the leaps nearly a riot of morning glory under the black-eyed Susan, whose seed someone had accidentally sewn into the inside pocket of his blue blazer. I think so, he or she murmured, as if peeing lazily halfway up the stair, and half of it falling into the dogwood, where a seasonal reference would not be too conclusive. The song of the meadowlark rising in spirals from the tender brush, and suddenly a host of grasshoppers invited the president over for a plate of Queen Anne's most intimate aspirations. Everyone thought that she or he would unfurl a golden assortment of window specks, except Morning Glory, which had been hammered underneath the asters, but barely had time to listen to its own most fervent declarations regarding the song and grasshopper leap, or buttercups unfurling from minarets. You wish for bottle caps and get Damon and Pythias down from that damn tree they're hung on. Susan, will you help us with the ropes? There's not enough pollen in these here pockets. apparent horizon. Light-edged leaves caught in sharp folds, invisibly contracting. Racing stationary seams, seeking absolute zero. Metal hammered thin, intersecting short rings. Pleated silver organs, moving under skin. Collars pressed flat into a green drop of air, a branching surface, veins the layered tops. Floating in mercury, only the face exhales its mist in setting sun. Anxious, ropey canvas. Pulling my limbs on the fracture table, some bonehead carps about modest progress in Iraq. Wireless transmitters in birdhouse camouflage, the public intellectual traverses a snowy country trying to keep his language sane. Everything is lighthearted, beatnik glory. The robins practice their mating dance on 2 inches of ice. Doves come 1 week early. Flocks of finches cross the line of value, explaining their reasons for the results, the talk that crystallizes around a phrase, bring it on. The amulets we still wear, anger building through gesture, draft by draft, loves, various and incompatible, neat, mass, mail outs, the pleasures of cranking cash, avoiding syntax, Red Bull charges up a transaction. Northern Parola. Oh, I should explain, the warblers are, they're addressing language of a particular poet in the North Hemisphere as well as the South Hemisphere. And there's a bit of, so for that reason, there's some foreign language in them. And I've just noted the Northern poet. Northern Parola for Ben Friedlander. Oh, Guadalupe hair lip, summer's enough now, Ron head thrown about, with not withholding thoughts, the tundra dreams plosive, lit beneath wonder, puffed, fluffed throngs, midst coastal fog belts, probing flowering catkins and scrubby thickets, wearing a yellow-green tunic lichen, boots of Spanish moss driving slow-moving short stacks, better be least gaunt, climbs and drops a note. In the rabiado, the martial kids id said, treetops be hanging from twigs. On reading John Donne at the farm. At year's midnight and the days, humming of fridge, stove pops, coyotes whistling on the hill, listen for the cock's crow, heading back down the ecliptic, time to groom the medicine wheel, an utter blackness, just dark, the world's whole sap is sunk, the soul stress lies on the night, dog stretched out by the stove, cats on top of one another, getting ready to sleep tight. Give and take. The sun sets behind a mountain over there, where we're going. The sun drops into the earth where we've been and travels all night. The turning. Heart, murder, still. Crow, hopper, sun, blood, hemlock, steel, waves, pushing, gold, crowd, cover, loud, sign, tail, wastes, fail, walk, wait, watch, wail, either, or, under, near, ahem, drum, om, hum, under, watcher, other, daughter, seals, wolf, nature, breaks, unleash, tigers, vault, hears, shadows, rising, earth, turns, space, declares, man, fact, fill, plummet, dumps, ether. golden planet lapping over currents, ducks hurtling, laughter, damage, rough, crazy. Sorry, Grant. Other, daughter, seals, wolf, nature. Oops, I'm sorry. Space declare. I'll back up a little. Space declares man, fact, fill, plummet, dumps, ether, golden, planet, lapping, over, currents, ducks, hurtling, laughter, damage, rough, crazy, drive, till, summit, glitters, shag, outworn, credo, undoes, after, spindle, night, weighs, brightly, scatters, waves, turns, into, spider, crescent, grass, plants, firm, stale, darts, form, flaps, pink, clouds, sumacs, clatter, stir, surprise, prey, Shiva, stick, sense, sight, ways, align, none, reflect, chance, shelter, buds, slays, gone, days, cold, bold, telling, drifting, selves, shed, blood, away, after, night, own. Carrion. What falls gets disposed of, completely moves through each other, a walk without disturbing the air. Monday's morning dove heard lone comes 1 week early in hard winter. No goose squibs, no grass. Feeder finches flame out in rage. A ribcage rakes up from the snow. The life we choose, not some movie tone. Joys at pips, squeaks, looking to score. Anger's uninvited lamp. Turn low the red, orange, blues, and blow my nose out. A salivating paradise killer just passes through nel mezzo on ice, walks into his next life, a game leg, tugs at war from eagle to eagle, a snow tattoo of juniper needles with a Celtic pelvis, Irma Vep's instep plays for this age. I saw a coyote pull my heart out from still hot fur on the pre-dawn ice. Thus begins my wandering year. Glad to be back. Black-throated green warbler for Mike Kelleher. Trees, trees murmuring from your black throat, a deep cup of grasses, sometimes in hardwoods, at edges, less susceptible. In the second growth, we're left together now. See me, be free, so three, hover glean and sallying from spider web to nest, sets aside human scale, looms 100 fires upside down, empties all accounts, vedados, zeros liberate winter. On Stepping Outside to Hear the Moonlight for Jonathan Williams. A barred owl whispers my name in low tones. Never heard one so close. Jonathan. Oh, Jonathan. After poking around with a light, I wait under the pine tree. A duck whirs upriver, looking for open water. The ice cracks, settles to an outgoing tide. A jet passes over. The neighbor's dog barks. That old owl keeps silent. Won't stir for no one, may be gone already. Sap moon growing, crows hunt worms at the snow's edge. A wind's in the boughs, says hello, Jonathan. I guess the sap moon is also known as crow moon. The month of April, the locals say that's when the crows start looking for worms at the edge of the ice. And I was talking with Christy at the Rust Belt this morning, and she was telling me that the what some of us call Marble Beach down there along the pier is being sort of raised and turned into something more fabricated. And I wrote a poem about that place a few years ago. I thought I should read it tonight. The Politics of the Unproductive. Who flee from me, them I did seek on the rubble beach of brick and marble strewn. Pure sidewalks tilted to water, learning up nothing. Low-flying cormorant lines between the platinum waves, pushing toward horizon, taut with the world, like the politics of not deciding, a counterweight, like the shore in this Army Corps-engineered lagoon, sits out of time, exempt from the breaking waves, like the fractured capitals tumbled to lyric connections to knowledge in the fragments of campus 5 miles off, maintain diversity through non-management from the same demolished facade, a Main Street bank the gulls don't give a shit on, and the ducks, kingfishers rattling in the trees of Bethlehem steel, hardly care too. Privilege recognition in the habits of the gaze. Learn to name in a few more weeks the poplars' leaves clattering here to give a pleasant shady shade, a wild picnic spot to be raised in time by the grand citizens' plans for yet another open to be considered the ways a thickness rather than line maintains the directions. And actually the marble that's on that beach is also the marble that's up at the lake on North Campus there. There's a fragment, romantic fragment there of a Greek temple. Magnolia Warbler, for Lisa Jarno. Here through you to me, Neef Schlepp Flepp Zek, black-saddled mister, calls about Newark and egg farms, a broad central band, white-edged fanning of red starts, thick-streaked necklace, yellow as yellow flowers, Pez Wichu O-rings, flicks tails of ox towns and magnolia trees, nets, one Alexander fluke, caribou and terns lined with fine black rootlets, fidgety individuals, dark cheeks of tepiques, curlies, curls of curlews, through moist spruce sings, sweeter, sweeter, sweetest. Nashville Warbler, for Wawin. Following burns or deforestation, we eat shy along the Bowery. If we chill, we'd sow less matter, or say hi, stay a while, time, torch, tune my slow fluttering wing beats of chinkapin chulos in the jackpine drive under the shade-grown fair trade without buzz, or rimming in the zocalo with a cough, no hypoxic kisses blow, circumgulf escapes, covered chilly river tiger, high and dry climbs chestnut timbers, garden ravens, slit songs in half, upslope islas, chomping numbers, sift spring from fall, Austin's covert bamboo shadows, bite spill in neck, tool a rich river, word at a time, San Blas, leaps into the territory, quick like that, chipping lower industrials, sharp bill, small size, dark antipasado bit seeps in manzanitas, the voracious, metallic, less structured endings, a rich, succulent fit. Melting snow patch. Outward saints and deputies echolocate sex lives. Like moth flutters to a bat, we lack avian analyses. Reflecting the daily reports, unshrinking grammar on the tight surface of the oil, water epiphanies in the suboxic zone. What do we mean by we? Latita, the sweeper woman, is gendered in many ways. Ask the electricity walla. whose song sparrows arrive with calm priestly demeanor, with no outward show and motion, in the dream of a video den. Just three woodcocks display their pixelated wares at the top of the driveway. Warbots lack the avian thing. Mass of bat times gravity equals wing loading ratio. Composite of nerves and thirst. Spiral erasure of verticals. April is car care month, but the light is fading above the earth. The electronic spink and burble of the starling articulates a convex bowl of fog, a mystery, a Phoebe-like sign at the oil change place. Dirty ducks, deerskin gloves, Charles Chester in the woods with his rifle, as Omega Man, spreading blue-silver pain, fires a few rounds into the family. The rock people begin to peek out from beneath the duff. No one wants this moment to last forever, to ascend into a golden atmosphere like a bald eagle or a fish, or Ellsworth Kelly ice shapes turning in an eddy. Even the rugged individual succumbs to the number of the breast. To wander is to saunter without the earth, to flutter, brickyard hen in the white light, in a mix of stars and clouds. And I think, maybe I'll read just two more. Nameless. The tumbling waterfall and lift up oversounding song of the winter wren in late summer. The countless red seeds of the nameless grasses grown tall, scratching your knees. The radiant moss on decaying stumps. The mushroom hyphae growing out quietly beneath the leaf litter waiting for rain. The drone of a hummingbird, ephemeral as a bit of morning light through the poplar leaves. The snap of a brittle, powdery branch under boot. The dry needle beds under hemlocks, and then the lush crowding of ferns. The quiet, methodical thrush on some lower branches, pooping against the white light. The songs of other nameless birds near the river making bowerwork of the air. The squares of peeled birch bark giving off false mushroom light. The glistening pile of deer droppings. The mossy root mass rodent town perforated with breathing holes. The homogeneous field of wet grass that is a tributary of the river, tide fed here in the deep woods. The large nameless black insect machine helicoptering towards your thigh. The mossy stumps, shades of previous logging. The poplar sketched clearing. The squelch of black river mud to your shin as you attempt an approach. The blades of long grass cutting knees. The wind in the treetops sounding like something coming. The ripped out crow feathers and one white feather under the dark pines, what news? The mosquitoes and flies circling around your head. The herbal smell of wet grasses along the edge of the farmer's mowed field. The dry-looking geranium by the nameless gravestone in the family plot. The countless ways through these woods. And the last is just a little acrostic for Lisa. And buy her book when it comes out. Lit in Sparrow Adams. Thank you.
So I'm so happy Brenda's here. I can't tell you. And Jonathan, too, Eve, of course. But I'm really happy Brenda's here, especially because I haven't seen her in, like, 5 years. So I actually met Brenda about 6 years ago at Naropa when I did a summer writing workshop. And she was teaching on poetics and community. And at the time, I had no idea how much her philosophies would eventually impact upon my own. And I can honestly say that I started the Rooftop Club because of Brenda. So we all wouldn't be here right now if not for her. So I really can't thank her enough for the wisdom that I've gained through her mentoring. It's been great. So Brenda's not only a writer and a poet. She's a folklorist, a sociologist, a documentarian, and a philosopher. And as one review accurately describes her very cinematic prose work as sculptures pieced together from bits of memory in a montage of American detritus, which we were talking about. How do I pronounce this before we got here? So her latest book, the marvelous book Bones of Time, consists of two manuscripts connected by an exploration of narrative folklore, found materials, and place. This first section, the Abolition Journal, is an investigation into borders, namely the north-south border between Davies County, Kentucky, and Spencer County, Indiana, where Abe Lincoln spent his boyhood. And I'm sure Brenda will go into this a little bit more. A Lonely Cemetery, the second section, begins with an exploration of narrative, namely the genre of the ghost story. So I know Brenda was out collecting narratives for this, and I can't wait to hear more about it. So with that said, please welcome Brenda Coltis.
Thank you, Lisa. And it's great to be reading with Jonathan and to see also old friends in Buffalo. It's been, I think the last time, the two times I was here before was to read at the Steel Bar. So with Michael one time and then with Simon Pettit, I think another time, right? Yeah. I'll probably read for like 25 minutes. So I'm going to start with a little bit of prose from the ghost story section, and then I'm going to go into the abolition work, which is, you know, the gazing at a boundary, the north-south boundary. But the first one I thought I would just read a couple of... this is a psychic investigation done over the phone with a friend of mine who lives in Oakland, California. So he sort of... We went to the Winchester House, which started a series of events and led to his relationship with some women who were psychic healers. And so I'll just read a few, just a little bit from that. Prophecies from the Angel Lady and Annabella. Robert, whom I've known for 30 years, is my co-investigator. He is Irish Blackfoot and a vegan. His father comes from the wilds of Kentucky and was a shell-shocked World War II veteran. His mother was an Irish war bride who always regretted moving to the United States. He had three sisters. One, Bessie Ann, died at 8 months old in Ireland. Throughout his life, Bessie Ann has visited him. When he was a child, he would see his mother in his room chasing away a gray shape and then covering him up with a blanket. One sister is psychic as a result of an unborn twin who attached itself to her uterus. His father worked at Fall City Beer Plant, sang along at a piano bar called Pegs, and rode a bike. His mother dyed her hair with shoe polish and shook her fist at her husband and always said, "I'm going to kill him." There was evidence of paranormal activity during his childhood. When his father was laid off, he would regularly find 35 cents, the admission price to the local movie theater, on the ground. He even heard the clinking of the coins as they fell from the sky. Robert's shoes are paint splattered. He found his calling as a painter in midlife. He is non-judgmental and accepts the absurd, but will not tolerate injustice. As a result, he has been in several fistfights. Women like to confess the bizarre, the taboo, or come on to him. Once a woman in a convenience store handed him a condom and said, "Here's my calling card." He wears his shirts but open, a button or two lower than most men. After our Winchester House visit, he met two women. One is a healer he calls the Angel Lady, and the other is Annabella, also referred to as psychic friend in this investigation. The two women are friends and share visions and impressions. Recently, they both had similar nightmares that led them to travel together to Brazil for encounters with flying objects. When Robert asked, "Do you mean UFOs?" the Angel Lady replied, "No, IFOs. They are identified flying objects." During the Angel Lady's dream, she wakes up in a small mansion, opens a door to a garden, and sees little lights blinking in code. As she travels downhill, the setting changes into a train station in a jungle. People wearing red gowns point, and lights surround her for her own protection. The Angel Lady then skips a part, which is not to be revealed even to Robert. In Annabella's dream, the lights are movie screens, but it's the same train station and lights. plus a vision of creatures descending from clouds and feeding her answers. He was introduced to the angel lady by Annabella because he was feeling poorly. He is not allowed to know her real name, but because of her natural glow and healing powers, he named her the angel lady. She provided him with a magic word for spiritual protection and healing. One day he ran into the angel lady at a health food store and she said, "Watch for colors." He thought she meant the paint splatters on his clothes. That day he saw a flash of black, and it was a dog that had jumped out of a window and landed in the bushes. If he hadn't seen it, the owners wouldn't have found the dog. A woman in red talking on a cell phone was almost run over by a truck. Robert pushed her out of the way. A kid in blue running ahead of his mother. Robert caught him before he ran into traffic. The angel lady predicted an event in which an unusual thought would prevent a brutal act. A week later, there was an incident involving a prowler with a knife. Robert knocked the prowler down and held a shovel to the prowler's throat. At that moment, as he stood above the prowler, about to plunge the blade into the man's throat, he had an odd thought about his recent UFO sighting, a formation of red lights flying over Oakland. This thought gave him a moment to think about the consequences, and he let the prowler go. A series of dreams about a loved one. Bob the cat died, and Robert was grieving the loss of this small creature. The cat was quite old and had suffered from cancer greatly in his last month. Robert cremated him and stores Bob's ashes in a sandwich baggie. Thus began a series of dreams about Bob the cat. In the first one, Robert dreamed of Bob dressed as a detective, and they were descending a staircase with a handrail made of hands with manicured nails. Robert said, "What a cliche," and one of the hands reaches out and scratches him. Bob looks up at him and says, "This is really going to hurt," and a long red cape grows from the back of Robert's neck. He turns into a beast, and as they fly down the stairs, he views portraits of family members, circa 1800s, which he is supposed to remember but can't. The portraits turn into light. Later on, as Bob leads him through this netherworld, Robert encounters Raylette the Radio Ray Girl, a character that he invented in high school. Since she is from another planet, she believes that Robert is a god, not realizing that he is merely human. Raylette asks him, "Are you the haunted one?" On Robert and Bob's bodies are tattoos that read, "Rumors of sleep, rumors of adrenaline, and this is black eye for pretty." The second dream takes place in a long warehouse, and there's a red-headed kid in a striped t-shirt and blue jeans. Robert sees something light falling down. It is an angel that has been harpooned. As the angel falls, it lands on the red-headed kid, pinning them both to a chair. Bob plucks out a feather for a quill and writes in a book. When Robert tries to look over his shoulder, Bob says, "No, not yet." The dreams that follow involve the book, and every time Robert tries to read it or look over Bob's shoulder, something violently thwarts him. Notes from the field. During the course of this investigation, Robert called me regularly to report on anomalies in his neighborhood. Odd events continued at the crematorium. I asked Robert to return and pick up any pamphlets about this history of the cemetery and the crematorium. When he went to the cemetery to ask for information, an employee began talking to him about funeral arrangements she had made for his family. When he tells her that she is mistaken about his identity, she begins to cry. It turns out that she believed Robert to be her long-lost cousin, Alejandro, who just lost his entire family in an automobile accident. Robert called to report two seemingly related events in his neighborhood. The water in the creek caught the fire, and that two men heard a Godzilla-like roar come from a culvert that feeds the creek. Within minutes, they were in the culvert with flashlights, but found nothing. About a month later, Robert was walking near the creek when he came across a couple from the neighborhood. Robert remarked on how wonderful it was to be spending the longest day of the year in the park. The woman said, "Yes, it really is the longest." They began discussing the creek and how Robert and some other neighbors had stopped people from dumping paint and toxic waste into the water. When Robert mentioned the water catching fire, they told him their story. On that longest day, they were having a picnic on the bridge when they heard a moaning coming from underneath. The man went to look down and saw nothing. And so he came back up. At that point, the woman was on the bank when they saw flames the size of a small table floating rapidly down the stream. And for about 1 second, she saw the outline of a human being drowning in the flames. Robert followed up on the story by asking a science librarian how the creek could catch fire and how the animal sound could possibly be related. Like the librarian said, the sound could have been feral cats. They often make a loud sound for their own protection. Also in the summer, the water runs slower and a patch of oil could ignite. As for the human outline in the flames, it was most likely a shadow. Then he added that he once saw the air catch fire. He was about 30 feet away and saw a flame suddenly appear in the air. It even looked as if it were trying to take on a shape. As a science-minded observer, he looked for a natural explanation. He even returned to the spot the next day to see if he could solve the mystery of the freestanding flame in the air. He concluded that there was no explanation. And then the second part I'll read from is from a project about gazing at borders and thinking about borders. And in this particular case, the border where I grew up, the border between the North and the South, between Indiana and Kentucky, separated by, of course, the Ohio. And looking back to think about during the time of the Civil War period and during the early part of the territories and so on, what sort of abolition activity, if any, took place. And so, the Abolition Journal are tracing the earthworks of my county. I found pathways and markers, but none which led directly north. I could walk and find an arrowhead or spear point. I could walk after the plowing and find flints. I knew someone, an iron worker, who could point out burial and village sites and river bottoms. These things can be proven with stone. I could follow these paths and find car bodies and dump sites, deer bones and garbage. I could mow a new path, still it would not be evidence. Even if the tobacco leaves all pointed north, it would not be evidence. I never worked or floated a boat on the Anderson River or ferried anyone across the Ohio. I did not walk to Gentryville to borrow a book or to repay 2 cents. I did not move to Illinois to practice law. I was not in love with Ann Rutledge nor Joshua Speed, and I did not marry Mary Todd, although I have always admired her. No, I have never split a rail, and indeed, I am not a Republican. Looking from the free state, there is a river, then a slave state. Turn around, and there is a slave state, a river, then a free state. I was born between the free side and the slave side, my head crowning on the bridge. I fully emerged in an elevator traveling upward in a slave state. I've shopped in the slave state and eaten barbecue there. I walked along the riverbank in the slave state and looked out at a free state. Lincoln looked out over the river and saw a slave state, and he was born in one, Kentucky, like me, but was raised in a free state, Indiana, like me. We were white and so could cross the river. Question: are there any abolitionists hanging from my family tree? Riding a yellow school bus through Lincoln City, are other Hoosiers, the residents of Spencer County, thinking of Lincoln? I was a Midway Panther, christening a Wildcat, Heritage Hills Patriot, surrounded in all directions by Tell City Marksmen, South Spencer Rebels, Tecumseh Braves, Boonville Pioneers, New Harmony Rappites, Utopians, and I used to call myself an American. I am a color that is an uneven beige, have a face with reddish tones, read about a man who is described as colored and free. If in the document she's described as an old darkie, then I might be described as an old whitey. I am the gelatinous mass that surrounds the yolk. Some of these places I knew the names of. Diamond Island is an island I have seen from the bridge. Wabash River I swam at. Peabody coal mines, formerly cornfields, I might have been drunk there. The documents describe a fisherman's hut. They describe a bank and a point. They describe a river. They pretend their business is bass, perch, and bluegill, which they sail to steam in flatboats, and they travel at night up Little Pigeon Creek from which my father fished. The engineer conducted a train regularly. He colored and freed the silent train, riders of what color, moving towards water. The train has a head and runs for the night, the lengthened carriage of it. Trees and crops fly by, driving through a finger of water, over the shoulders of a river, into the mouth of a creek, towards a point on shore. Put this in your pocket to confuse the bloodhounds when you are moving toward a point in the distance across water, which divides countries. Moving to a point or to point out over here or there, there's a shore of woods and someone points and makes a place. Travel by night and let no one see you. In a matter of tracking a passage through grass, how difficult after 100 or more years. A historian wrote, Mrs. Delia S. Weber was known to have helped slaves across into Indiana, especially south of Jeffersonville. He is known to be a slave catcher and hunter. He is known to be sympathetic to Kentucky. He is known to be a liar. 100 years hence, will there be markers commemorating where we had borrowed a book? Will there be symbols pointing out our former dwellings and facsimiles of our living rooms? Will our belongings be preserved? The childhood books and clothes, journals and cursive handwriting? And if the original is missing, will they write, this is similar to, or this is of the period? From the tobacco warehouse, old Uncle Simon led the others out, saying, freedom would do him no good now. Me, a blade of grass township, Spencer County, southern Indiana. I thought of Klansmen when I thought of Indiana. I thought of the Imperial West Wizard, Stevenson, 40 miles to my west. And so I thought to know what is better about the folks of my county. Southern sympathies travel over water. Only in my 47th year did I know I was a Yankee. Hoosier, a backwards person, a frontier corruption of who's your daddy. The executives of the Anti-Slavery League in neighboring counties. Ira Caswell's was the first station in Warwick County. His family said, a lone tree from his orchard still standing and the traces of his homestead, and asked Peabody Coal to preserve this abolitionist farm, and of which we await the coal breath's answer. And did there exist Colonel William Cockrum's Oakland City Station, as the plaque suggests? The 21st century mayor's late 20th century house rests on the site. Did Dr. Posey's coal bank shelter passengers guided by stars? Who chumped up this site, Black Beauty or Peabody Coal? The president of this railroad, Levi Coffin, of Wayne County, too far north to count in my poem. Emancipation Proclamation. If I said emancipation, or if I said manumitted in this county, if I said reparation, some might say those are fighting words. Or if I said Lyle Station, the first black town in Gibson County, or I could say Stevenson Station, a black settlement within shouting distance of the South. In Vandenberg County, I could say Lincoln Gardens, a historic housing project in Evansville. In the history of the county, they wrote CO for color. Of Lyle Station in 1849, I could certainly write the best cantaloupes in these sandy bottoms and the first African Methodist Episcopal Church. I could write a station existed run by a free man, Thomas Cole. I could write these nearby whites, David Stormett, John Gaithers, David Hull, assisted passengers. I could write the author of Lyle Station yesterday and today asked why this history has been left out of the textbooks. The palmist heard many voices, a mournful ocean coming from my right hand, and felt a deep sadness. She heard, I went to the underworld, and this is what I found. She heard, I have her body. And then I heard the word, and the word was autonomy. Born 93 years after, my mother born in Indiana 62 years after, her mother born in Kentucky 1896, her mother born in Kentucky, and during her lifetime, the first grandchild born 121 years after the news of emancipation. Got in there. Thank you.
The Rooftop. Rooftop Poetry Club is a service of E.H. Butler Library at Buffalo State College. Our website is www.buffalostate.edu/library/rooftop. Go there to see what's coming up on our calendar, to find info about joining, to read member bios, and to connect to our excruciatingly thorough archive of past projects and photos. Thanks to our performers, to Lisa Forrest, and to Buffalo State's instructional resources for technical assistance. And thanks again to you for listening. We'll see you next time up on the roof.